Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Welcome to New Books in Economics, a podcast channel of the New Books Network. I'm Tim Jones, and my guest today is Tara Mukindo-Calder, co-author with Tara Bedi and Rogelio Mercado of Hyperinflation in Zimbabwe, Background, Impact, and Policy, published in 2019 by Palgrave Pivot. Adam Ferguson's History of the Weimar Republic's Hyperinflation became a surprise publishing hit in the wake of the 2008-9 financial crisis, more than three decades after its release. Nevertheless, despite the delayed public interest in the detail, the 1923 hyperinflation was already legendary in its impact, and its impact on the German psyche is still palpable today. Yet this is by no means the only hyperinflationary episode in the past century. Indeed, two countries, Venezuela and Lebanon, are experiencing hyperinflation as we speak. The worst ever example was in post-war Hungary, but the second worst took place just 13 years ago in Zimbabwe, when at its peak, prices rose 80 billion percent in a month. In her book, Dr. Mukindo-Calder, herself a Zimbabwean who now lives in Dublin, examines the meaning of hyperinflation, how it developed in Zimbabwe, how it was stopped, and how this process compares to other hyperinflations. Born and raised in Bulawayo, Tara Mukindo-Calder has been an economist at the Central Bank of Ireland since 2011. Having studied development economics with Paul Collier in Oxford, she completed her PhD on money demand, aid shocks, and the impact of land reform in Zimbabwe at Trinity College Dublin under the supervision of Patrick Honohan, who later became her boss at the central bank. There, she has co-written a series of papers, mostly on the debt overhang and small business in Ireland. Tara, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks, Tim.
Before we start, I think it's essential to define two terms that are going to come up a lot in the discussion. The first is hyperinflation itself, which, as you point out, isn't just very high or very fast price inflation, as we can now see in Sudan, Syria, or even in Zimbabwe. And the second is seigniorage. Could you explain to listeners what these two terms mean?
Sure, Tim. So hyperinflation, as defined by Kagan, is inflation rates of over 50% per month for a period of time. So these can be compared to sort of chronic inflation of a slightly arbitrary cutoff of 50% price rises per month, which do happen, you know, fairly regularly. But hyperinflation is a situation where prices are rising so quickly and inflation expectations are rising so quickly that the sort of demand for holding money falls dramatically. And it has a lot of sort of real economic impacts as well as monetary impacts. Mm-hmm. And then seigniorage is very interesting. It's the real expenditure governments can generate from printing money. So in normal times, governments or the monetary authorities generate revenue just from the act of printing money. They can buy, you know, real goods and services with those. But they typically don't maximize this revenue stream because of the relationship between inflation and the price level and people's demand to hold money balances. So if inflation increases substantially, people choose to hold less money. And if we think of seigniorage as a sort of tax on money, an inflation tax, the tax base is eroded if people are less likely to hold currency, hold money balances. So typically governments don't maximize this revenue stream, which can be quite substantial. But in hyperinflationary environments, governments can use seigniorage as one of their revenue options, although it's short-lived because ultimately agents just hold so little, you know, demand holds so little of the domestic currency that the currency becomes untenable.
Yeah, and as you say, you do have something very interesting to say about that in the book, but we'll come back to that. So in April 2009, the power-sharing government in Harare finally withdrew the Zimbabwean dollar from circulation after the worst bout of hyperinflation in, the second worst bout of hyperinflation in world history. Can you take us through the events and the policy decisions that led Zimbabwe from independence to basically the death of the Zim dollar?
I can do my best. So I guess Zimbabwe was one of the countries in sub-Saharan Africa to achieve independence pretty late compared to other countries. It achieved its independence in 1980, although it had unilaterally declared independence in 1965. So 1980 saw a majority government begin ruling the country after a protracted war in the country in order to achieve that. And international sanctions were decisive in ending the war and had, you know, extreme economic impacts. So 1980 was, you know, a time of a lot of sort of positive feeling towards the country, the end of sanctions, majority rule government, you know, calls for unity. And you know, there was a big bounce in the GDP in the first couple of years of the country's independence. But they were in, you know, from almost the beginning of the country's independent history, you know, substantial macroeconomic challenges. So first of all, the protected industries, the industries that had grown up underneath the in a sanctions environment were not competitive in a more liberal trade environment. And there were also sort of substantial distributional issues which needed to be addressed with associated large public expenditures, sort of education, housing, etc. And, you know, there were also sort of political, you know, the political stability concerns, which were substantial over time. So I guess in the 1980s, you know, there was sort of an attempt to introduce some sort of macroeconomic stability, allow, you know, some sort of trade liberalization. And that really in the 1990s, despite substantial concerns, for example, with climate events, which had big effects on both welfare, affecting the ability of the predominantly rural population to grow and harvest their own food. You know, there was almost a sort of demand by indigenous manufacturing and business owners for a more liberal environment. So Zimbabwe was one of the few places that sort of voluntarily went into structural adjustment with the big donors, agencies, IMF and the World Bank. But it's difficult for these four newly independent countries. And actually, I've done some work comparing Ireland to Zimbabwe, which sounds bizarre. But in fact, you know, one of the parallels is that it does take, you know, some time for countries to sort of fully internalize what, you know, living in a sort of independent, economically liberal environment means for fiscal expenditure, basically. So there were big challenges with the structural adjustment programs in the 90s, exacerbated, as I say, by some very substantial droughts, which were very detrimental. And then at the end of the 1990s, there were sort of two events. first of all, the country chose to go into a conflict, an armed conflict, supporting the Democratic Republic of Congo. And secondly, chose to pay very large pensions to a very large interest group, the war veterans, at the end of the 1990s. And those things were not funded using the existing sort of funding options available to the country. So, you know, if you can't raise tax, if you can't raise external debt, if you can't get aid agencies to pay for these things, then one of the few remaining options is monetary financing. Mm-hmm. And so that's exactly what happened, which, you know, resulted in very high rates of inflation from sort of 2000 onwards. Although the inflation profile, you know, wasn't consistently low between 1980 and 2000, it was sort of managed or more manageable. So perhaps there were inflation rates of close to 20% in some of those years, but they were relatively short-lived and were usually associated with things like droughts or civil conflict, other impact on the productive capacity of the country. But the sort of inflation that was initiated by this military adventure and these pensions to the war veterans, as well as the land reform then, which had a big impact on the productive capacity of the country, just meant that it became very difficult for the government to find other ways to finance its budget other than monetary financing.
But I mean, those are all quite issues that are quite specific to Zimbabwe. But in Chapter 3, you run through the history of hyperinflations and you find a common causal pattern. Can you talk us through these?
Yes, exactly. So that was one of the really nice extensions to the work that published in Applied Economics that Rogelio brought to the book, the sort of nice comparison with historic hyperinflations. And as we lay out in the book, sort of hyperinflation is, you know, it happens, but it's quite rare. I think we talk about sort of less than 50, probably less than 30 if hyperinflationary events since 1900. So, but the common theme is that, universally hyperinflation is due to monetary financing. So it is due to the monetary authority not being distinct or independent from the fiscal authority. And it occurs when there is large pressure on the fiscal authority, when the government cannot easily finance its own budget. So this usually happens where there is large negative impacts on the productive capacity of the country. For example, immediately after a war, for example, in Germany and other European countries between the two world wars and indeed after the Second World War. So countries experience damage due to the war itself or may lose a large portion of the country due to the treaties at the end of wars. But this can also happen, for example, when countries transition from command economies to market economies. So it's not the market economy per se, it's the new way that the government is required to manage its expenditure, basically. So in that way, I think we find that the Zimbabwean hyperinflation is most similar to the hyperinflation, in fact, in the Democratic Republic of Congo in the mid-1990s. So precipitated by large negative impact to productive capacity and then the monetary authorities not being able to find any alternate ways to finance expenditure and then sort of the currency losing credibility.
In the book, I forget where, but you refer to the spillovers from hyperinflation into daily life, mass migration in search of hard currency to remit home, the departure of health workers and a consequent drop in immunizations, spike in cholera and maternal deaths, and this idea of teachers having to make ends meet by smuggling essentials over the border. And this is something I've always found hard to grasp, what it really means to live somewhere where prices are doubling on a daily basis. How do retailers even know how to price anything? Is most business essentially done between hoarders and consumers, and you know, standard economic activity basically changes overnight?
Yeah, so it's the sort of real impacts of monetary phenomena are, you know, astounding and very far reaching. And so what you describe is accurate, that alternate ways of doing business, alternate ways of purchasing and selling, you know, did eventuate in Zimbabwe, but it didn't happen overnight. So the very high inflation levels happened overnight, well, very quickly. And that had big, as you say, knock-on effects to how businesses were able to price their own goods, keep stock on the shelves, especially in an environment where the government was, you know, not keen to accept that it was part of the reason for the high inflation. And so it did implement price controls at various times because it sort of maintained that the private sector was bidding up prices speculatively, which was causing the destabilization, causing the hyperinflation, and having these really negative real effects on people's welfare. So, you know, that then had very substantial real effects, and that there were no goods on the shelves then if shop owners were not allowed to price, you know, price the hyperinflation in or the very high inflation rates in. It was very difficult for them to restock. So there was, you know, and sort of crucial things like fuel, for example, were price controlled always, and also subsidized by the government. So, you know, when the currency became non-convertible, when we couldn't use our own currency to purchase fuel, you know, from our neighbors, from South Africa, for example, then there were large shortages of even things like that, which were controlled goods and, you know, were price controlled, and the government had subsidized them for a long time, as is the case in many African countries that don't produce their own oil. So in the early 2000s, not only did we have this very destabilizing land reform process, which, you know, displaced over 200,000 farm workers. So there was huge amounts of unemployment, but then there were huge shortages and things due to the inflation, for example, fuel. So they would just, people spent hours and hours and hours queuing in their cars to get fuel in order to go about their daily work. So, you know, teachers and nurses and doctors were spending large portions of their time in fuel queues, sort of overnight, waiting for, there might be a rumor that a fuel, you know, fuel would arrive. And it took a long time for these, they were termed runners. So people who were able to go across the border, small, you know, individuals go across the border, buy real goods to come and sell them at home. And I think in the book we mentioned that civil servants were able to go to South Africa without the need for a visa. This was a very viable outside option for them, you know, when their real wages weren't keeping up with inflation. But it took time for all of those things to become established. And also it relied on having, you know, the right contacts, you know, at the right time and the right places. So, you know, there was a lot of hardship whilst people sort of established those new ways of running their lives. And I think people in the urban areas were maybe more able to do that. You know, those links were more easy to establish. But in rural areas, there was a huge amount of hardship. You know, I can remember, you know, going somewhere and stopping on the side of the road, as you would usually do, to buy curios. So, you know, loads of, you know, beautiful things made, you know, out of wood and whatever by very talented people all over the country. And they didn't want cash because by the time they would be able to get the cash to anywhere that they could use it to buy medicine or food or whatever, it would be worthless. Mm-hmm. So they were much more interested in, you know, real goods, t-shirts, you know, shoes.
Yeah. Well, that's a question. That was a follow-up question I had, which is, do you have a rule of thumb for when the inflation rate essentially becomes meaningless? I mean, I mentioned 80 billion% in the intro, but what can that possibly mean? I mean, at that stage, no one's going to use the currency, right?
Except for the, you know, the currency was the way that the government collected tax. And it's one of the, you know, when I was presenting this work initially in Trinity, I can remember one of the questions was about the tax raising ability of the government. And actually that was one of the things that they did quite well. So that was one of the last things to fall away, you know. So if they had any resources or any, you know, strategic response, it was to make sure that they carried on collecting tax revenue. And because that was denominated in the domestic currency, there was a lot of, pressure to carry on collecting that. So it was enforced that the domestic currency was the one that was used, you know, in any kind of formal setting. So, you know, and there were substantial sanctions if you were found to be using hard currencies instead of the Zimbabwe dollar. So, you know, people were imprisoned sort of regularly. You know, it was really a stressful time. Like if you were in business at all, it's sort of the rule of thumb was don't go to work on a Friday afternoon because you would, you know, that's when the police will come around and do their checks and you'll be in prison overnight because you won't be able to get it over the weekend because you won't be able to get a lawyer. So although there was huge pressure to, you know, and one of the real assets that people could accumulate, or there was huge demand for, was hard currency, especially the US dollar. But it was a sort of a very risky strategy because of this, you know, big pushback from the government. So it was, but ultimately that did fail. So the government was able to insist that everybody use a currency until sort of late 2008. And that's why in the paper, the sort of empirical analysis only runs to sort of early mid 2008, because really from the middle of 2008 onwards, you know, despite the government's best efforts, people were using alternate currencies increasingly because, as you say, like, you know, it was just sort of meaningless. And not only, you know, not only was it the inflation rate itself and the rapidity with which prices had to change, but also there was real problems with physically obtaining cash. So in the book, when we compare, when we're measuring the price series, you know, establishing a new one of the things we consider, you know, we consider kind of six price series, one of which was the cash rate, one of which was the hard-boiled egg, one of which is the cash rate. So at the end of the week or the month, whenever businesses, and there was still manufacturing and, you know, some retail and obviously there were some farmers, commercial farmers, some mining, you know, some sort of engineering supporting the mining activities, all very labor intensive. You know, when business owners were looking to pay their staff predominantly in cash, very few people were banked at that time in the country. Mm. And also there had been various banks that collapsed. So people were very reluctant to use banks. Finding actual physical cash was a big problem. So the government couldn't keep up, the printing presses couldn't keep up with the amount of physical cash that was needed in order to facilitate even basic economic activity with prices rising that quickly. So first of all, you know, the slot in the ATM machine is only kind of less than an inch high, and that's actually not enough space to get the amount of notes out that you need to stand there for hours in order to get the amount of notes out that you would need to kind of buy a loaf of bread. Mm. So you would have these queues outside banks, people turning up with duffel bags, you know, in order to get these bricks of cash out of the bank. But there were daily limits to how much you could get. So business owners had to pursue other strategies. So for example, purchasing cash from high cash, you know, from high cash turnover businesses, for example, takeaways. Mm-hmm. So there was a domestic chain of takeaway chain that was had a presence sort of throughout all the towns and cities. And they would sell cash to other business owners in order that they would be able to pay their wages. So they would get an electronic transfer, a huge premium, and then hand over the physical cash. So it really, so people started spending a lot of time just negotiating, you know, the what high, very high inflation over an extended period of time means for an economy. Hugely inefficient. So when you learn about menu and shoe leather costs as an economics undergraduate, that's what it looks like.
Yeah. Well, the opacity in the data meant that you had to develop, as you mentioned earlier, you had to develop a couple of tools to conduct the study. The first was a new price index, and the second was a model of money demand.
Yes.
Can you talk us through those and how it was that you found them to be more accurate than other proxies like the hard-boiled egg index, et cetera?
Yes. So this work is based on my first PhD paper, and Patrick Hoonahan was a really fun supervisor. Hmm. So, you know, it was kind of an evolving thing. So we had a look at the IMF work that had been done on the inflation in Zimbabwe in the sort of very early 2000s by Menars and Kovanen. And those are really interesting, but they found that real money balances sort of increased around 2005, 2006, which was really strange, you know, given both the lived experience and also the sort of predictions of a money demand model during periods of high inflation. So we thought about it and, you know, we talked initially about, well, maybe there's a timing issue between when the money balances, the nominal money balances in the country are published, say end of month by the Reserve Bank, and when prices are gathered. And indeed that was the case. So prices were gathered in the middle of the month and money, you know, the money balances were published as end of month figures. So that helped a little bit, but then we realized that was very small impact. And what was really going on was the basket of goods that the CSO was able to gather information on was just not reflective of the true price levels, the true inflation rate in the country. So the CSO was just not able to keep up with the evolution of the basket of goods and how they were priced. And similarly, when it comes to, you know, hyperinflation, sort of the price level needs to be known on a daily basis. Mm. So, for example, when prices are going up, you know, so rapidly, wages need to be renegotiated very frequently. So perhaps usually wages are renegotiated once a year. It became sort of twice a year in 2003, maybe. And then it became monthly, and then it became weekly that wages were adjusted. So you needed a much more timely, easily available price series. Or when you're thinking about estimating money demand function, thinking about series that were available at a much more regular frequency to the agents in the economy. Mm. And so, as I said before, when the inflation rate became very high, and even in the, you know, earlier periods in the 90s and the 80s, you know, foreign exchange was an asset that everybody knew the value of, and, you know, everybody was trying to accumulate in order to hedge, you know, as well as other things. Mm. So there were various ways that you could measure sort of the real or the sort of black market exchange rate. The official exchange rate was not so useful for that. although that plays kind of an important role in the hyperinflation in general. But the parallel market rate, or the black market rate, I guess, is something which you know, large numbers of people from all walks of life would have kind of known on a daily basis, and that's how people thought about prices. So that's what we kind of aimed for. And it was really fun. So it involved kind of developing relationships with people in private sector finance company that used to publish this data regularly, and then also trips to the British Library to find the World Currency Yearbook parallel market rates for the country for the sort of 80s and early 90s. It was kind of a detective experience in some ways.
And you concluded from that the hyperinflation began 6 months earlier than the Reserve Bank had concluded. How did they get that so wrong?
It's to do with the way that they were measuring prices. So they were not, they were resource constrained. I think it was the Central Statistics Office, actually. Mm. They were resource constrained, that, you know, they weren't able to measure the, you know, price of the meaningful basket of goods that, you know, informed the sort of aggregate price level in the country. Mm. There's also a lot of disincentive for the CSO or the monetary authority to acknowledge that inflation, you know, was as high as it was. Mm. So, you know, there are also difficulties there, which we see in other countries when they go into high inflationary periods, for example, in Latin America.
Yes, that's certainly true. Well, a really intriguing part of the book is your discussion of, and we mentioned at the beginning, this idea of senior ridge maximization by the state. And you find that from independence until the hyperinflationary peak, an inflation rate of 27% per month, so roughly half Kagan's definition, would have maximized senior ridge revenue. And that the seigniorage revenue stream essentially converged with this maximization stream from 2000 onwards. And as you point out with a bit of understatement, you know, the policy in this respect is inherently short run. But what wasn't clear to me, are you suggesting this was ever a conscious policy decision to do this?
I mean... I think, you know, the government's budget deficit was huge. It was substantial for the entirety, almost the entirety of the country's independent history. But when the productive capacity of the country collapsed in the early 2000s due to the fast track land reform process, you know, which is a conversation for the other day, for another day. And, you know, there was definitely need for redistribution, but the way that it was carried out meant that the agricultural productive capacity collapsed, and agriculture formed the inputs for a lot of the domestic manufacturing. So domestic manufacturing also collapsed. And that's where that was the tax base, you know, formal sector employment and privately owned businesses. So when those things collapsed and there was no replacement from the international donor community, monetary financing was one course of action. And then I do think that the seigniorage revenue streams, you know, became important towards the end. And, you know, one of the things that wasn't clear to Patrick and I when we kind of thought about this was, you know, how expensive would it be to run this as a policy? Like, you know, they already have the printing presses running all the time. They were actually importing the banknotes from Europe from a German company, you know, because it is important that the banknotes are not easily counterfeited. Mm. So they did have costs, you know, substantial costs associated with printing so much money all the time. And yet, you know, the seigniorage revenue that they were generating, you know, was really substantial. And yeah, so I think it could have been an act of policy towards the end, very short-lived.
That is amazing. the authorities, or at least the ZANU-PF side, always claimed that the main reasons for the hyperinflation were sanctions and price speculation, and which is sounds like the kind of thing the Venezuelan authorities say today. You come to a different conclusion. On what basis?
So again, it's kind of, you know, interesting how the narrative evolved. So when I was thinking about the paper, formulating the paper, you know, that is definitely what the government was saying at the time. And when I presented that, you know, the research proposals and whatever to senior academics in Dublin, for example, you know, it comes across as kind of a straw man, you know, something easy to disprove. But it was a really pervasive narrative in the country at the time that price speculation was the problem. And then when sanctions were imposed in the sort of, you know, early 2000s, you know, that then became the second sort of dominant narrative. And it really took hold and was quite persuasive, you know. And so there was, you know, there was support in fairly wide-based support, I think, initially for some price controls, you know, in order to try and deal with sort of this private sector price speculation and whatever. And then, you know, the absence of goods on the shelves and, you know, chronic shortages and basic commodities, you know, then I think people started to realize that it was a sort of more complex issue. So empirically, you know, you can test whether prices cause money supply to expand or vice versa. Ideally, you would have an instrument, which I couldn't find an instrument for the empirical analysis, but I used two sort of different empirical approaches, and they seemed to suggest that prices were not self-perpetuating, that there was, that the relationship ran from money to prices rather than the other way around. And then, you know, as to whether sanctions caused the hyperinflation, I mean, you know, as I said before, the huge contraction in the tax base in the early 2000s meant that there was, you know, very, very large unfinanced government deficits. And, you know, it's hard to know whether the authorities really expected international agencies to fund, for example, the fast track land reform process as it was implemented. You know, there are differences of opinion about the quality of the Lancaster House Agreement that sort of dealt with land ownership, you know, at independence and all the way through to the late 90s. So, you know, it's difficult to know whether the authorities sort of could legitimately have expected aid agencies to sanction or partly fund the land reform as it was implemented. But the reality is that, you know, there wasn't substantial amounts of money forthcoming, and there was a huge hole in the budget deficit, you know, in the budget. So, you know, which had to be financed somehow. So I guess in a roundabout way, you know, that was a contributing factor, although we do say, we do find in the book that, you know, assistance, development assistance remained forthcoming at similar orders of magnitude than before 2000, all the way through the period under investigation in the book. So it's not that there wasn't any international assistance. It's just that the international assistance did not come, you know, to fund the fast track land reform, which I guess, you know, was a factor.
Yeah. Now, you point out that out of all the other hyperinflations, this is in chapter three again, the way Zimbabwe ended its episode was unique because it withdrew its own currency and replaced it with the US dollar. Because the government became convinced it couldn't regain sufficient credibility with a new domestic currency, which is the typical response. there are varying accounts for who was responsible for this, whether it was Patrick Chinamasa from the ZANU-PF government or from Tendai Biti when he joined the Government of National Unity. Do you happen to know?
I don't know. I think, you know, Tendai Biti was an important and positive force for change when he held that ministerial position. And, you know, the currency, the suspension of the domestic currency and the adoption of the hard currencies, US dollar and South African rand, you know, saw, you know, rapid stabilization of prices and, you know, return to some normality for consumers and producers, employers. But unfortunately, the reforms were only partially implemented. That you know, was the problem, that there wasn't full implementation of the reforms. So you kind of need to reintroduce credibility in the currency. And as you say, the Zimbabwean policy to suspend the domestic currency is fairly unique. But you also need to, you know, implement substantial fiscal consolidation in order that these large gaps in, you know, government expenditure are shored up. And that, of course, has, you know, substantial short-term negative impacts if it's to do with state wages or state services or investment in state agencies. So it was that piece that you know, was not fully implemented, that reform piece. And then thirdly, you know, and it's sort of, you know, broadly accepted in lots of places that you need independence between the monetary authority and the fiscal authority.
Yeah.
And that also was not implemented. I'm not really sure if that was even mooted. But yeah, so actually, I was just looking at the IMF's 2020 article for on Zimbabwe, and the language they use is, you know, they describe it as Zimbabwe as experiencing hyperinflation again. Right. So at the end of 2019, the inflation rate was 521%, they say, with, you know, 50% people food insecure, GDP contracted by 8.3% in 2019, not expected to grow at all in 2020. And this was kind of before COVID-19. Mm-hmm. So, you know, if you don't implement those three things in a sort of credible, consistent way, you know, Zimbabwe indicates, you know, what can happen then.
Are you still running the model, actually? I mean, because do you have an estimate for where inflation is now compared to where officially it is?
I don't. That would be interesting to have a look at. Yeah, and actually one of the challenges I think the country faced when it introduced the hard currencies was because it was an informal adoption, like there was no formal agreement with South Africa, for example, to use the currency. There was a preference domestically for using, at least in some places, for using the South African rand, in part because the size of the denominations of US dollars were just too big for most goods and services that would be exchanged in Zimbabwe. But because there was no formal agreement, you know, to enter a currency area or use the currency, there were huge currency shortages in 2009, 10, 11 of foreign currency, in part because, you know, the productive capacity was so reduced, and so there was very little export going on, very little, you know, foreign currency generating activity occurring. So there was also some domestic pressure from consumers and producers to introduce a local currency in order to deal with the currency shortages. You know, they had experienced substantial currency shortages during the hyperinflation, and this was of a different type, you know, to do with the denomination of notes and unavailability of foreign currency in Zimbabwe. You know, so there was sort of a demand you know, from producers and consumers rather than something imposed by the Reserve Bank or the government in any way. So I think that's kind of an interesting aspect of it. So initially, just sort of very small denomination coins were introduced as a new currency, the Zimbabwe local currency, and then it's been, you know, more formalized since then. Mm. But a shame that those other reforms hadn't been introduced.
Yeah. Well, finally, because this is a podcast about books, I ask every guest for a book choice, and I did warn you in advance. So what is your recommendation?
I really like Invisible Woman by Caroline Credo Perez, something completely different. Yep. But again, sort of economist as detective and policy advocate, and probably reflective of some of the, you know, still distributional issues that I'm interested in, but sort of gender gap issues as well. But I also also really love Chimamanda Ngozi Adichie's work. So Half of a Yellow Sun is, you know, phenomenal, but Americana, you know, the sort of story of an African migrant in a cold northern country, I really like that as well.
you can empathize with that.
Exactly.
Okay, well, today I have been talking to Tara Makindo-Calder about her Hyperinflation in Zimbabwe, Background, Impact and Policy, published by Palgrave Pivot. Tara, thank you again for joining the podcast.
Thanks, Tim.